Welcome to Torah Imecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Michelle Levine, and today we are studying Perek Yud Aleph, Chapter 11 of the Book of Daniel. This chapter continues from Chapter 10, delineating the angel Gabriel's portentous and fateful revelations to Daniel about the future destiny of Am Yisrael under the empires of Persia, Greece, and beyond. Gabriel notes in verse 1 that already in the first year of Darius the Mede, whose transitional rulership paved the way for Persia's eventual takeover, the celestial war with the ministers of Media and Persia, who wanted to oppress the Jews, was taking place. This lengthy chapter is highly detailed in its descriptions of the ensuing kings and empires who will rule and persecute the Jews before the onset of the Messianic times. But while it is astoundingly specific in its descriptions, there is also a degree of ambiguity and obtuseness, which complicates the identification of specific world events to which they are referring. But this is deliberate. For while the divine plan has been set into motion, and as we learned yesterday, it is inscribed and the decree is irrevocable, nevertheless, with regard to the specific ways in which the plan is implemented, there is a measure of flexibility depending on human choice and actions. Notwithstanding, our commentators, many of whom sincerely believe they were living in pre-Messianic times, and that Mashiach's arrival was indeed imminent, read the verses of this chapter with a keen eye to its historiography, and meticulously analyzed how the texts relate to events that have already taken place on the world scene. As there are divergences among the commentaries, for the sake of consistency, I have chosen to analyze this chapter from the perspective of Abarbanel in his work Ma'ayanei HaYeshua, Wells of Salvation, which I have cited in previous chapters, particularly section 11 of this work. This work was written in the late 1490s, while he resided in Monopoly near Naples, having been expelled along with his fellow Jews from Spain in 1492. Abarbanel sought to reassure his fellow Jews that redemption is on the horizon through his copious work on the Book of Daniel. Notably, this work is part of a trilogy of compositions about Messianism and Jewish eschatology, the other works being Mashmia Yeshua, Announcer of Salvation, and Yeshuot Mashicho, Salvation of the Anointed. Importantly as well, we should take note that having served under Christian rulers, Abarbanel also had an underlying polemical agenda in his analysis of Daniel, in order to refute and debunk Christian claims about their ideology and their Messiah. Abarbanel draws historical information from the Jewish chronicler Josipan, Yosifun, whose book was compiled in the 10th century CE in southern Italy, not to be confused with Josephus, along with other commentators such as Rashi. But fascinatingly, Abarbanel also avails himself of Latin history books and chronicles. His commentary shows a comprehensive knowledge of world history, which he applies to deciphering and decoding the vague texts in our chapter. Abarbanel presumes, like the sages and Rashi and Ramban, that the four kingdoms are to be identified as Babylonia, Media Persia, Greece, and Rome. Consequently, according to Abarbanel, the schema of this chapter is as follows. Verse 2 depicts events relating to the Persian kingdom. Verses 3 through 35 describe the wars between the two dynastic principalities of the Greek kingdom. And verses 36 through 39 relate to the Roman Empire, especially the rise of Christianity in the 4th century CE. In a second interpretation, as we will discuss, the history of the Roman Empire begins in verse 31, with the description of the destruction of the Second Temple, and continues through verse 39. The downfall of this fourth kingdom is depicted in verses 40 through 45, and continues into chapter 12 as well. Accordingly, verse 2 describes the rule of three kings over Persia, Hine od shlosha melachim omedim lefaras, and a fourth king, who is described as far richer than all of them. Abarbanel maintains the four kings include Cyrus the Great, Cambyses, son of Cyrus, Ahasuerus, and Darius the Persian, during whose time the Second Temple was completed. While historians have noted there were many more kings of the Achaemenid Persian Empire, Abarbanel's reading corresponds to that of the 2nd century CE chronology source used by Rashi and other commentators, Seder Olam Rabbah, and as noted in Josipan. In verse 3, a mighty king arises and conquers Persia, ruling with great dominion and doing as he willed. He is identified as Alexander the Great of Macedonia, who defeated the Achaemenid Empire in 330 BCE. Yet as the angel predicts in verse 4, וכעומדו תישבר מלכותו, ותחץ לארבע רוחות השמיים, ולא לאחריתו, ולא כמו שלו אשר משל, כי תינטש מלכותו, ולאחרים מלבד אלה. As soon as he will establish himself, his kingdom shall be shattered and divided into four directions, but not to his posterity, nor like his domination. For his kingdom shall be uprooted and shall be for others besides those. This corresponds to the historical testimony that Alexander the Great died at the age of 32, soon after consolidating his empire in 323 BCE, presumably from malaria or typhoid fever. Alexander's empire was divided into four major kingdoms by his successors, as there was no clear heir to his empire. Among them were two predominant kingdoms that are the main subject of Daniel's vision in this chapter: the Ptolemaic kingdom, encompassing Egypt, Cyprus, and parts of Asia Minor, and the Seleucid kingdom, which dominated Syria, Mesopotamia, and Persia. Therefore, from verses 5 through 35, Abarbanel surmises these two major dominant kingdoms, the Seleucid and Ptolemaic kingdoms, are the kings identified in our text as the kings of the north and the south, respectively, and these verses relate the constant wars between them. Abarbanel demarcates that verses 5 through 14 relate the conflict between the Seleucid and Ptolemaic dynasties through the reign of Antiochus III. According to Abarbanel's historical analysis, in the late 4th century BCE, Seleucus Nicator establishes the dynasty that rules over Persia, Asia, and Greece. Its heirs are given the title of Antiochus. This northern king clashes with Ptolemy I Soter, the founder of the Egyptian Ptolemaic kingdom. In an attempt to reconcile their differences, we learn in verse 6, ולקית שנים יתחברו, ובת מלך הנגב תבוא אל מלך הצפון לעשות מישרים. At the end of years they will join together, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to make an agreement, literally to establish uprightness. This refers to the marriage of the daughter of the Ptolemaic king to Antiochus I Soter, son of Seleucus I, in the mid-third century BCE. But as verse 6 continues to relate, she will not restrain the power of the arm, that is the kingdom, and she will be surrendered. The concubine of Antiochus of the north revenges against this betrayal by her husband, kills the Egyptian wife along with her newly born son. Consequently, the tenuous alliance between Egypt and the Seleucid dynasty disintegrates. In the following years, Ptolemy III of the south, brother of the slain daughter of the south, takes revenge. As verse 7 relates, a scion from her family will arise on his foundation and confront the army of and enter the stronghold of the king of the north and prevail over them. This military campaign begins a series of southern victories over the northern kingdom. As verse 8 testifies, he, that is the king of the south, will stand secure for years against the king of the north. But during the late 3rd century BCE, an internal coup in the northern kingdom results in the rise of Antiochus III, who aims to reclaim victory from the south. As verse 10 relates, he will inundate and agitate as he passes through until he reaches his stronghold, that is, the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom initially prevails, however, as verse 11 testifies, but ultimately it is attacked again by Antiochus III, as reported in verse 13. Veshav melech hatzafon vehemid hamon rav min harishon, ulekeitz ha'itim shanim yavo vo b'chayil gadol uberechush rav. The king of the north will once again raise a multitude greater than the first. At the end of time, several years, he will launch an attack with a great army and vast resources. Interestingly, among Antiochus III's supporters are a group described in verse 14 as Uvenei paritzei amecha yenaseu la'amid chazon, sons of lawless men among your people will exalt themselves to establish a vision. According to Abarbanel, this refers to false prophets among the Jews residing in Egypt, who, having suffered under their oppressive rule, predicted the demise of the Ptolemaic kingdom. When this did not materialize, they were considered to be rebels and immediately killed, as noted at the end of verse 14. From verses 15 through 19, the text relates in detail Antiochus III's military campaigns. Significantly, he strikes against the land of Israel, for the Jews there supported the Egyptian kingdom. As verse 16 recounts, V'ya'as haba elav kirtzono ve'en omed lefanav v'ya'amod be'eretz hatzevi v'chala biyado. The invader will then do to the southern kingdom as he pleases, and none will stand in his way. He will also stand in the coveted, beautiful land, that is the land of Israel, with annihilation in his hand. Yet Abal ben El observes that Antiochus III does not destroy Israel, but instead annexes it to his permanent kingdom. Antiochus's invasion of Egypt requires much strategy and effort in order to succeed. As the ensuing verses relate, since he does not succeed in his first attempt, he tries instead to outmaneuver his foe by once again arranging a marriage, as related in verse 17. This is the marriage between the daughter of Antiochus III, Cleopatra, and the Egyptian king. Ve'asa uvata nashim yiten lo lahashchita, ve'lo ta'amod ve'lo lo tihiyeh. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but it shall not succeed, and she will not be his. Antiochus III wanted Cleopatra to help him destroy the Ptolemaic kingdom, but his scheme was foiled. Cleopatra instead chooses to be loyal to her new Egyptian husband, thwarting her father's plan to conquer the southern kingdom. Ultimately, Antiochus III does not succeed in his repeated attempts to reconquer the Egyptian kingdom. Abal ben El notes that our text reveals that this is all part of the divine plan. As verse 18 relates, V'hishbit katzin cherpatolo. The commander will cause his insolence to cease. From Abal ben El's perspective, the commander is Hashem himself, who is the officer and watchman controlling the world. It is Hashem who caused Antiochus's insolence to cease from realizing its goals against Egypt and against Jerusalem. Continuing with the history of the Seleucid dynasty, verse 20 records the succession of Antiochus's son, Seleucus IV, in the early 2nd century BCE. Who is deposed a short time after, and succeeded by his brother, the infamous Antiochus IV Epiphanus of the Hanukkah time period. Therefore, Abai ben El surmises that verses 21 through 35 describe the reign of Antiochus IV Epiphanus, concluding with the description of the Hasmonean revolt. Because Antiochus IV is not the rightful heir to the throne, as Seleucus had left behind a son, he is referred to in verse 21 as the contemptible one, who possessed the kingship with glibness. He reinvades Egypt, noted in verse 22, with a deceitful strategy, as pointed out in verse 23. Antiochus pretends to come peacefully to the southern kingdom to visit his kin Cleopatra. Through his deception, he manages to victor Bima'at Goy with few men against the Ptolemaic dynasty. Although verse 25 recounts that the southern army attempts to vanquish the Seleucid warriors, it does not succeed, especially since, as noted in verse 26, the Egyptian nobles, those who eat of his royal food, turn against their leaders. Ochle fat bago yishberuhu. Yet Gavriel reveals to Daniel that Antiochus will eventually meet defeat at his time, according to the divine plan. As verse 27 testifies, Ki od ketz lamoed, there is an end for the allotted time. Nevertheless, initially, Antiochus IV Epiphanus sets his sights against the inhabitants of Israel, intending to persecute them to submit to Hellenistic culture. As verse 28 relates, Ulevavo abrit kodesh, his heart is set against the Holy Covenant. Antiochus is particularly furious when the Jews demonstrate allegiance to Egypt, when he is defeated in a military campaign against Egypt, noted in verse 29, where the Egyptians had sought out the help of the Romans, referred to as the Kittim in verse 30. As such, verse 30 relates, V'za'am abrit kodesh, he will be enraged against the Holy Covenant. Antiochus IV's persecution of the Jews in Israel is elucidated in verses 31 through 35. Thus, the desecration of the fortified sanctuary and the placing of an abomination in the temple, alluded to in verse 31, V'chilulu hamikdash hama'oz, v'hesiru hatamid, v'natanu hashikutz hamishomem, is a historical prediction of Antiochus's defilement of the Second Temple. Antiochus imposes his Hellenistic pagan worship on the Jews through flattery and guile in verse 32. And the corruptors of the covenant, Marshi'ei Brit, described here, are swayed to his side. the persecution of intellectuals loyal to the Jewish faith, is poignantly depicted in verse 33. Umaskilei am yavinu larabim, v'nichshelu b'cherev, uvelehava b'shvi, uvebizah yamim. Wise men among the people will give understanding to the multitudes, but they will stumble by sword and by flame and through captivity and plunder for years. But the people who know God, especially the Hasmoneans, will persevere and succeed, as verse 32 relates, and as is further delineated in verse 34, Uvihi kashelam ye'azul ezer me'at, and in their stumbling they are helped through the aid of a few, alluding to the victory of the small Hasmonean army against the Greeks. Despite this prophecy of hope, the vision continues to relate that the Hasmoneans will ultimately be defeated in their own wars. Hashem will not permit a total victory for the Jewish nation until it is refined and purified from its sins. For as verse 35 tragically predicts, the Hasmonean period is not yet the designated time for complete redemption. Abarbanel's analysis of this chapter maintains that its historical information centers predominantly on the Greek Empire. However, Abarbanel also posits that the latter part of this vision may allude to the reign of the final fourth empire, the Roman Empire, and the rise of Christianity. As such, in an alternate reading, he reinterprets verses 31 through 35 to refer to the history of the Roman Empire and the rise of Christianity. Thus, verse 31 on the desecration of the temple refers to the Roman destruction of the temple. The persecution of the Jewish intellectuals, especially the 10 martyrs, is alluded in verse 33. The remnant, the settlement of Beital, that will provide some help to encourage Jews to remain faithful, is hinted to in verse 34. Continuing with this reading, Abarbanel interprets verses 36 through 39 to refer to the rise of Christianity. The powerful king depicted in verse 36 refers to Constantine, who established the Christian Byzantine Empire in the 4th century CE. His acceptance of the doctrine of Christianity is elaborated upon in verses 37 through 39. For example, the practice of celibacy among Christian priests is alluded to in verse 37, which describes that concerning the desire for women, he does not show any regard. How does this chapter conclude? Verse 40 begins a description that is pointedly given the time frame, uve'et ketz, and in the time of the end. In these last verses, Abarbanel interestingly does incorporate the role of Islam within his eschatology, even though he maintains that the mark of redemption will be the downfall of the Roman Empire. Abarbanel presents Islam as a component of the divided Roman Empire. Recall the vision of Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2, that the final empire would be split. While Abarbanel views Christendom as the prevalent power, he cannot deny that Islam has exerted great influence over world politics. Therefore, he interprets verses 40 through 45 to refer to the final clash between Christianity and Islam that will take place before the redemption. Reassigning the identities of the northern and southern kings, Abarbanel interprets that verse 40 recounts that the northern Muslim forces will clash with the Christian empire, wherein the Christians will embark on a crusade to enter the land of Israel, Eretz HaTzvi, as related in verse 41. The Christians will succeed in conquering Muslim lands in Egypt, as verses 42 through 43 report. But in verse 44, the Muslims will retaliate, determined to set out with great anger and to destroy and annihilate many. And although, as verse 45 relates, the Roman army will set up an offensive in a strategic area between the seas and the mountains of the Holy Land, it will be defeated. It will come to its end, and there will be none to help him. Notably, the fall of Constantinople into the hands of the Turks in 1453 during Abarbanel's lifetime sharpened the conflict between Christendom and Islam in the 15th century. As the Turks conquered many areas of Europe, the Christians feared the Muslim forces would destroy their capital, Rome, and bring about the downfall of the Christian empire. These events apparently influenced Abarbanel's interpretations of the final vision in Daniel. Yet Abarbanel inferred that from these texts, the Christians would rally against the Muslims. And indeed, in 1500, 8 years before his death, soon after he completed his commentary on Daniel, a combined Spanish-Venetian army recaptured one of the main Greek islands, Kefalonia, which succeeded in impeding the Turks somewhat. But Abarbanel also interpreted from this vision that the Muslims will rise again to destroy the Roman Empire. It would require divine intervention through the Mashiach to bring about the downfall of the Muslim forces and the final Geulah, the subject of our next chapter. In this chapter 11, through Daniel's powerful, lengthy vision, we have taken quite a journey through world history. What we need to keep in mind is how, in this vision, how the predictions in this vision have materialized throughout the centuries, even though there is still room to reinterpret the specifics of this vision to apply to contemporary times. But this should give us all hope that Geulah has been inscribed as part of the divine plan, and may we merit for it to arrive soon. This shiur is dedicated by Arlene and Arthur Ice and Michelle and Dove Schwartz and families, Le'ilui Nishmat, our beloved and much missed father, William T. Steinlauf, Tritel Ze'ev Ben Baruch, on his 25th yahrzeit. His love of Hashem, Torah, community, and family has served us as an inspiration and guide for his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren.